All right, well, welcome. Welcome to the fourth lecture of Mini-Science 2009, To Infinity and Beyond. I'm Charles Gale. I'm the chair of the Department of Physics, and this is the Physics Building, and we all welcome you. So there's an exciting lecture for you tonight in this Mini-Science series. Last week was Professor Tracy Webb, also a physicist. She gave a wonderful lecture on Alien Universes, the Nature and Origin of Galaxies. So if you weren't here, things that you missed are different galaxy types and their characteristics, how and why telescopes are time machines that enable you to see billions of years in the past, and how galaxy mergers induce star formation and black hole formation. So please visit the website URL on the board, so mcgill.ca/science/mini for the answers to the following questions. Questions that were raised last week. Are all elliptical and spiral galaxies disk-like? And if so, why? If black holes are at the center of galaxies, why does the center appear bright when looking at pictures? Good question. What is that makes a black hole dormant or active? Can a dormant one wake up? So please check it out. It's very interesting stuff. Now, quiz for people that were here last week. From last week's lecture. So our galaxy, the Milky Way, is on a collision course with another galaxy. So which galaxy is this, and how long would this take? Say that again. Andromeda, yes. How long?
4 billion years.
3 or 4 billion years, very good, very good. So that's the bad news. The good news is you still have time to finish your taxes. I can't help it. In the early universe, approximately 2 billion years after the Big Bang, we see some key differences in galaxies compared to what they are today. What are these differences? So name three of them. Are galaxies then and now different?
Producing more stars.
Right. Very good. Very good. Most stars form in the early galaxies, yes. Two other differences. Yes? That's possible, but that's not what I have on my sheet. That's possible. Yes, that's right. More black hole creation. And what else? Yes, exactly. More galaxy mergers. Very good. So, finally, what are four key differences between spiral and elliptical galaxies? Four of them. One of them is fairly obvious. That's also possible. Let me give you the easy one, the shape, okay? So spirals of disc and spiral arms, while elliptical are round and football shape. Okay, fairly obvious. Yes, exactly right. You were obviously here and paying attention. Very good. Very good. Okay, so the composition, the spirals will contain a lot of gas and dust and still making new stars. Two of them. Mass? Which one is more massive? That's correct. So elliptical galaxies tend to be more massive than the other one. And finally, where? That's possible, but, well, it's related to that. Location. So ellipticals are often found in galaxy clusters, while spirals are often found in isolation or smaller groups. So a little bit of housekeeping announcement. So we'll have question and answer this week. So after the talk, I'll invite you to write your questions on a sheet of paper and pass them to our volunteers, and I'll read the questions to the speaker. So please do not write any questions you don't want me to read. They'll go on the web. On the internet for the world to see. And don't forget to fill in the evaluation form you got from the front desk. Very important. We like to do what you like to hear. And the Faculty of Science inaugurated its new blog today. So again, the URL is on the board. Check it out, and you can post comments about mini science or about science in general, and read the blog from our dean, Dean Martin Grant, again on the board. So tonight's speaker is Professor Andrew Cumming. Andrew is an assistant professor in this department, in the Department of Physics. He's a theoretical astrophysicist. Physicists come in two flavors, essentially, theorist and either experimentalist or observationalist. So Andrew is a theorist, as I am. He studies the physics of compact objects and extrasolar planets. So this will be the topic of tonight's talk. Extrasolar planets is very rapidly and changing field in astrophysics. It's very, very hot, very topical. It's so topical that yesterday, April 21st, was announced a new discovery of the lightest exoplanet so far. I believe Andrew will talk about this in his presentation tonight. So very exciting stuff. It's so topical that it goes on as we speak. Andrew got his PhD in physics from the University of California at Berkeley in December of 2000. He was a Hubble Fellow. It was a prestigious fellowship at the University of California in Santa Cruz. He held this from 2001 to 2004. He came to McGill in 2004, and in 2006, he received another prestigious fellowship, the Alfred P. Sloan Research Fellowship. So you can read about Andrew and his research in the biography notes that you've gotten when you walked in here. So I'm very happy to present to you and to welcome Professor Andrew Cumming.
Thank you, Charles. So it's a pleasure to be here tonight to tell you about a new field, as Charles mentioned, a new and rapidly expanding field of exoplanets. And what I want to show you is that we've moved in the last 10 years from a phase of discovery in this field to a phase of characterization, and I'll explain what I mean by that. So that's why I came up with that title. And I'm going to show you, to start off with, just what you should hopefully take home from today's lecture. And the first thing is that you should go away. I'll try to give you a sense of what planets have been discovered in the last 10, 15 years. There are now 300. Actually, we'll see exactly how many, but more than 300 planets have been discovered around orbiting other stars. The message really is that planets are common in our galaxy. We didn't know that 10 years ago. It's an important question to answer. Planets are very common, as far as we can tell. And they are unexpectedly diverse. Okay, we used to know one solar system, the one that we live in. Turns out that's quite an atypical solar system. The solar systems we're finding are very, very different. And then I'll try to talk a little bit about at the end about what you can expect to see coming in this field in the next 5, 10 years and beyond. And there the idea is that we're moving to finding Earth-like planets around other stars. So why study planets? You know, whenever you think about a subject, that's probably the first question you should ask. Why am I here? The first question is, are we alone? Okay, what I mean by that is, we'd like to know, in our galaxy, are planets rare? Is life rare? Is life common? Are planets common? Is life common? We'd like to have a census of the population of planets in the galaxy and try to detect, if we can, life around other planets in the galaxy. Where did we come from? In astrophysics, as you've heard in previous weeks from Matt Dobbs, you heard about the early universe and looking at the cosmic microwave background and exploring the early universe. And then you learned about the formation of galaxies and the evolution of galaxies over time. One of the big questions in astronomy and astrophysics is to try to get a sense of where are we coming from. So in planetary science, where did our solar system come from? How were the planets made? And the idea is by studying other solar systems, as I'll show you, we get a much better handle on how that actually happens. We live on one. Okay. If we want to understand how our planet works, it might be a good idea to try to look at as many as possible. If you look at one system, this is a message I'll try to get across in the talk. If you look at one system, you don't learn as much as if you can look at many, many different systems. And actually, today is Earth Day, I believe, that is actually today. So it's actually quite appropriate to talk about this. If we want to look after the Earth and understand the Earth better, maybe we can start by looking at other planets also. And this is more for physicists, I guess, but extreme conditions here is the last point I put here. You heard from Vicky Caspi in the first lecture, I think, of the series. You heard about neutron stars. Now, Vicky would actually say, hey, planets don't have extreme conditions, not like neutron stars. I think a teaspoon of neutron star weighs so many battle... not battle stars. I watch too much TV. Aircraft carriers is usually the thing that people talk about, but a planet isn't that dense. But nonetheless, if I go into the interior of Jupiter, as I'll talk about, if you go to the most massive planet in our solar system, inside Jupiter, it's so dense there that the hydrogen, for example, could be a metal. You compress the hydrogen so much it's metallic. It's no longer a gas. And so those conditions don't naturally occur on Earth. And so a planet's a good place to investigate them. Okay, so... Do you recognize this? What is it? It's a galaxy. It's M81. It's a Milky Way twin, we believe, or close to the Milky Way. Now, hopefully after last week, you know how to locate the... Do you know how to locate the sun? Where are we in the Milky Way? We're on one of the arms. We're actually... So we're 8 or 9 kiloparsecs from the center. It's 30,000 light years, something like that, from the center, and we're... In one of the spiral arms of the galaxy. And I just want to show you this to give you some context. Okay, so this galaxy is tens of thousands of light years across. And I just want to contrast that with the size of the solar system. So you zoom into one of those spiral arms, and there's a star, a sun, an ordinary star in the galaxy. And I'll talk now about our solar system. How many stars are in this galaxy? Billions, maybe 10, 100 billion stars. So just think about how many stars there are. How many planets do those stars have? How many of those planets have life? That's the question that one of the big questions we'd like to answer in this field, and something we're getting a handle on recently. Okay, so zoom in by a lot. We're going to zoom in by a factor of something like 10 to the 7, 10 to the 6. Okay, and we come down to our solar system. Okay, so here's my favorite solar system. what's shown here is the sun, so our star, the sun. Here it is on the left, and it's so big that we can't squeeze it into this diagram. Okay, so here it is. We can just show a tiny part of the sun here at the edge of the diagram. And this diagram is to scale in terms of the size of the objects, but not in the spacing. The planets are much more widely spaced than this, but in terms of the size of the objects. And on top are the eight planets, and on the bottom are the dwarf planets that we know. So we have Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. I think there's some mnemonic to remember that, but I couldn't recall. So I'm sure you can all have your fun mnemonics for that. And in the handout, I gave you some information about these planets. It's a lot of numbers. But the idea is to talk a little bit about the solar system. What I'm going to do is talk a little bit about the solar system, and then I'll contrast that and show you the exoplanets that we found, and we can contrast and say, you know, do the exoplanets look like the solar system? And before I do that, here are some more numbers, just to give you a sense. So I've given you some scales of mass, radius, and density, and I'll come back to these numbers. So let's just look at the masses. Let's think about mass. Okay, what's the mass of the Earth? Here it is. It's 6 by 10 to the 24 kilograms. And that doesn't mean too much, but that's the mass of the Earth. But what's important is to think, just to look at the relative scales within the solar system. So the Earth has that mass. Jupiter, the largest planet in our solar system, is a mass of 318, so roughly 300 Earth masses. The Sun, the star, has a mass of 300,000 Earth masses. So that's the scale as we go through the solar system from Earth up to Jupiter to the Sun. And in terms of radius, it's about a factor of 10 every time. So the Earth's radius is 6,400 kilometers. Jupiter is about 10 times larger in radius, and the Sun is about 10 times larger still. So if you look back at my previous plot, you see it's roughly to scale. Here's the Sun, this big, and here's Jupiter, and there's the Earth. Okay. And the density, I'll come back in a moment as to why that's important, but Here I've given some densities. Okay, what's the density of water? It's about 1 gram per cubic centimeter. A cubic centimeter is roughly a teaspoon, something like that. So if I take a teaspoon of water, there's about 1 gram there. If I look at iron, that's 7.9 grams per cubic centimeter. It's 8 times denser than water. Of course, iron, a lump of iron will sink into water. And then in the middle there, I put granite. I looked up granite. That has a density of 2.7 grams per cubic centimeter. I take that as an example of a rock. Okay, so I'm going to talk about rocks, and I'll talk about iron. So by rock, I mean something like granite. A typical rock has a density of about 3. And this is something we'll try to do. We'll try to measure the densities of these exoplanets. It's one of the aims. Okay, now I also gave you a big list of numbers here. Okay, but it's just to get a sense of two things about the solar system. So one is, what do the orbits look like? What do the planets are going around the sun? And what do those orbits look like? And also, what are the physical properties of the planets themselves? So if you look at this, I've given you the orbital period. So this tells you, how long does it take for the planet to go all the way around in its orbit? And, of course, the Earth is at 1 year, 1.0, because that's defined. That's how the year is defined, of course. So those are the orbital periods. So they could range from about a couple of months for Mercury. It goes around every couple of months. And if you go out to the farthest planets, Neptune, Uranus, then you're talking about centuries to go all the way around the Sun in their orbits. And then in astronomy, we define a unit of distance, which is called the astronomical unit, which is AU. And the Sun is defined to be at 1 AU, sorry, the Earth is defined to be at 1 AU from the star. So in these units, we place the Earth at 1, in these distance units. It's actually, on the previous slide I have here, it's 150 million kilometers. So that's the size scale of the solar system. It's the distance from the Earth to the Sun. And in those units, you get a sense of where the other planets are. So Mercury is in a 0.4 AU, so 40% of the orbital distance of the Earth. Neptune goes out to 30. Okay. And then the other thing I look at is, talk a little bit about is eccentricity. So the orbits of the planets around the Sun are ellipses, and we can characterize the shape of the orbit by the eccentricity. If there was some chalk, I would draw picture, but so if we have E equals zero, maybe there is some, but if we have an eccentricity of zero, that means a circular orbit. So the planet just moves in a circle. Thank you. So I'll try and draw a circle. It's not so easy. Whoops. Try again. There you are. If I have an eccentricity larger than zero, as I make it larger, and the maximum value is one, but as I make it larger, what happens, so if I make it bigger than zero, not equal to zero, larger, so you know, make it 0.5, for example, then what happens is that the orbit is an ellipse. I can't really draw ellipses either, it turns out. And the Sun is sitting here at what's called a focus of the ellipse. That's the Sun. And then the planet moves around in this elliptical orbit. And you can see what's happened. You've taken the circle and basically squashed it and pulled it to one side. You've made the orbit distorted like this. And what happens is that the planet quickly moves around the close part and then very slowly moves out to a very large distance and then comes back and then quickly whips around. That's the kind of motion that we have. And the larger this number, closer to one, the more extreme this is. Okay, so what do you notice about these numbers here? Relatively small. So the orbits in the solar system tend to be circular. They don't look like this. They look like this. Okay. Very, very, quite circular orbits. Okay, so let's just move on to talk about a little bit about the planets. What do they look like themselves? And if you stare at this table, I've given you the mass, the radius. If I know the mass and the radius, how much mass is in the radius, I can calculate the density of the object. And I've just listed those 8 planets. Here they are. And you can see, if you look at this, you can sort of group them into 2 groups. So the first thing is to look at the mass. If we take the 4 inner planets in our solar system, they range in mass from 0.06 all the way to 1 Earth mass. But if you, when you go into the outer solar system, into the gas giant planets, you find that the mass is much larger. Here, Jupiter has a mass of 300 Earth masses, 100 Earth masses for Saturn, about 20 Earth masses for Uranus and Neptune. So we can naturally divide the solar system into 2 groups, the inner planets, which are relatively not so massive, and the heavier outer ones. And I put the density here So you can see there's also a difference in the densities. The inner planets have densities of 4 or 5 or 6 grams per cubic centimeter. Now, whereas the outer ones tend to be, say, 1, around 1. So what does that mean about the composition? Let me ask you a question. More gas, right? That's right, more gas. Hydrogen and helium here, and here, rock. Okay? Let me show you what we think those planets look like. Okay, so here are some cartoons with cutaways so you can kind of see inside. Now, here's a picture of the Earth, of what we believe the structure of the Earth looks like. It's basically a rocky body with an iron, so mostly iron core. If you blur your eyes there, don't look too much at the details. I hope there are no geophysicists in the audience. But if you blur your eyes there a little bit, you can basically think of the Earth as an iron core. Remember, that had the highest density. That was the most dense material in the core, surrounded by a mantle, what's a shell known as the mantle, which is basically mostly rock. Okay, so you think of this as a rocky body. And the gas giant is a very different structure. It's mostly gas. Now here in the middle, you see in the middle there's a brown sphere in the middle. And that is a rocky core. We think that Jupiter may have, we don't know for sure, but Jupiter may have a rocky core whose mass is around 10 Earth masses. So I take the Earth and make it 10 times more massive and then surround that with 300 times the mass of Earth in gas. And that's basically Jupiter. Okay, so a rocky core and then a big load of gas on the outside. So that's basically how to think about these gas giants and the rocky planets, the inner solar system and the outer solar system. And then, just to conclude, I have a lot of words on this slide, but I just want to take you through what's happened. Let me get to that. So that there's a basic picture of how these planets form. So I mentioned that we would like to understand where the solar system actually came from and how it formed. And so what I wanted to do is, now we have a sense of what the planets look like, give you a sense of what the history was. And if you don't want to read those words, let me just say a short version is that you take small things and you stick them together and you make bigger and bigger objects. That's basically how we think the solar system formed. Okay, and I have in detail here 5 steps. So what happens is that we believe the star, you probably heard a little bit about star formation last week. The sun formed by a cool, dense cloud of gas collapsing. And that cloud of gas collapses to make the star. But when it does so, it forms the star, but some leftover gas is present, which makes a disk. So I have a star in the center and a disk of gas, a flat disk of gas, which is circling, orbiting the star. And a good piece of evidence for that is that the star, the planets in our solar system are in almost a coplanar orbit. They all move in the same plane, all of these circular orbits are all lined up in the same plane. And that's, we believe, because they all form in this disk of gas that was present around the forming sun. Now, inside that disk of gas, there's dirt, basically dust. We call it, in astronomy, you call it dust. It's basically little particles of graphite, carbon, silicate particles, basically micron-sized, micrometer-sized dust particles. And the idea is that you slowly stick those together. Eventually, you make centimeter-sized objects by sticking them together. Those centimeter-sized objects can start sticking together. Eventually, you get to kilometer-sized objects. Think about how many scales we have to go here. Kilometer-sized objects, then the kilometer-sized objects can start to collide and stick. And those kilometer-sized objects, how far do they have to go to make the Earth? 6,400 kilometers in radius. So we're going from micron size, 10 to the minus 6 meters, all the way up to 6,000 kilometers. That's how we believe the Earth formed. And it takes probably a million years, or maybe a few million years, to do that, to have that process. So that's how we believe the Earth formed, basically by sticking together bits of dirt at some level. Now, there are many problems there. I've just told you a story. And you should ask, do we really know that's what happened? We don't. It's just an idea, and it's something we'd like to test. And Charles mentioned, you know, I'm a theorist, Charles. So theorist, a good theorist can always come up with an explanation for one observation. And that's a little bit of the situation we were in. I exaggerate, but of course, because we can study our solar system in great detail. We know a lot about our solar system. But in some sense, we only knew one solar system 15 years ago. And a good theorist can explain that one solar system. But imagine if I now hand you 300 solar systems. We're going to be able to do a lot better. Okay, so that's really the message. In the last 15 years, we now have 350 solar systems that we can try to test this picture here. Okay. I missed out one point, which is that I didn't talk about gas giants. So we make the Earth by sticking these dirt particles together. What can happen is that when I get to 10 Earth masses, if I keep growing and growing the rock to 10 Earth masses, then what can happen is it has such a big gravity, it can pull in gas. And so that's how Jupiter grew. Its rocky core got to 10 Earth masses, and then it pulled in a load of gas. And that's why, if you remember, the structure was a rocky core, about 10 Earth masses, and then it has a lot of gas on the outside. So that's the picture of how we believe these planets came to be in our solar system. Okay. So what I'd like to do now is to take you through the search for planets and the results. So I'm just going to tell you about how we do this, and I'll tell you about the exciting discoveries that have been made. So most of the planets to date have been found by what's called the Doppler technique, radial velocity technique. So radial velocity searches refers to the kind of technique used to detect the planet. And the idea is that we're used to thinking in my diagram here, I drew a nice diagram of the sun and the planet moving around the sun. But if you imagine being the sun, your very massive body, very big, 300,000 times as massive as the Earth. But as the Earth moves around, you get a little bit of a gravitational tug. So as the planet moves around, what actually happens, the sun is moving also a little bit, because it's being tugged gravitationally by the Earth. And the idea is that it's very hard to see planets directly. They're so faint, such small objects. But we can see the star, and we could look for that motion in the star. And that's what people have done. So we let the planets are moving around. We can't see those. But we do see the star, and we see how it responds to the planet moving. And it is a tiny, tiny signal. I've written down here the size. 10 meters per second is the speed at which the sun is moving as Jupiter moves around. Jupiter is by far the massive planet in our solar system. So as it moves around, it's the one that really is responsible for the motion of the star. And that motion turns out to be 10 meters per second. Now that's, if you think about this, you know, we're looking at a star 100 light years away. And we have to measure a speed of 10 meters per second. Right. I can't run at 10 meters per second, but it's a speed you can imagine, right? It's a tiny speed compared to astronomical objects. Now, how do we do it? You use the Doppler shift. So, you know, when the ambulance goes by, when the ambulance is coming towards you, or maybe if you used to go to the Grand Prix, I hate to bring it up, but the ambulance is coming towards you, the siren is high-pitched. And then when the ambulance goes away, it's a low pitch. So an object moving towards us, if it's emitting waves, those waves are squashed. The wavelengths are squashed. And that's what I tried to draw here. So if you imagine our sun, here's Jupiter. Jupiter's the tiny dot here, and it's moving around. It's pulling on the sun. It's causing the sun to move around in its orbit, to move around a little bit at this tiny speed. And if the sun is moving towards the observer, the light it emits is shortened in wavelength, blue shifted. I guess you heard about this last week, blue shift and red shift, of course. And if when the star is moving away from us, it's redshifted. So we just look for that blue shift and redshift. Now, if you think about it, how do we do that? We can look at we can look at spectral lines in the stellar. Here's a spectrum of a star like the sun. And there are all these lines from absorption by particular different elements. And we could say, okay, I'm just going to look at a line, and I'm going to try to measure how the wavelength shifts with time. But the problem is you can calculate the shift, and it's one part in 30 million. Okay, so I have to measure the wavelength of that line to one part in 30 million. If I can do that, I can detect planets. Okay. So in practice, how do you do this? It's very difficult. It took many years to get this right. You look at many lines. That's one thing. Don't just look at one. Let's look at many. Let's look at trying to look at 10,000 lines, something like that, if we can. Let's also have a reference. What people do is they take an iodine cell, and they put the iodine inside the path of the telescope, the light coming into the telescope. So the light goes through the iodine, and that has a very fine structure of absorption lines, which give you a reference set of wavelengths that you can compare against. So the star lines are moving like this, but the iodine's fixed And then so you can do a comparison between the two, and that's basically how people do it. And the best measurements actually beat this by a factor of 10. So they do 1 in 300 million. So it's really an amazing measurement. Okay. And what does it look like? Okay, so this is a typical data set that comes out. So what's plotted here is velocity. So I make a plot of the measured velocity. And notice the units are meters per second. And here the scale goes from minus 60. Minus would mean the star is moving away, for example, and plus might mean the star is moving towards us. And it goes from minus, say, minus 40 here. The measurements go from minus 40 all the way up to, say, plus 40, something like that. So it's a swing. It's a change in velocity of about 80 meters per second. Over a time scale, here you see from 0 days, which is an arbitrary starting point, 0 days out to 1,200 days. So 4 years. 4 years of measurements here. And look at the error bars. Look how precise these measurements are. They're only a few meters per second. So we can tell the velocity to within a few meters per second. Now, what do you think? Is there a planet here? Yes, yes. You know there is because there's a theoretical curve plotted here under the data to guide your eye. But look what happens. You go at time zero, you measure the velocity, it's around 20, plus 20. And then you wait half a year, you go back, you measure the velocity, it's down at minus 40. The big swing, right? And you go back, half a year later, it's coming up, and it goes down, okay, it comes up again. These variations are due to a planet. What can you tell me about this planet? Can somebody tell me something about the planet?
It's not round.
The orbit?
The orbit is
so actually, this one is quite circular. It looks, it's sort of going up and down pretty smoothly. So it turns out this one is almost circular. The thing you can get here is the period. You can get the orbital period. Because you see, it's quite close. You see, it goes down and up, and it comes around in about 700 days. So that's 2 years. So it's as close to the star as the Earth. Okay. Now, what you can't tell from this plot, unless I tell you, is the mass, because we can get the mass by saying how big is this velocity shift. If it's a really massive planet, it'll really tug on the sun, and the sun will have a big velocity change. And if you just ask how massive must this planet be, it must be as massive as Jupiter. Okay, so this is a Jupiter-mass planet, and it is really close because it's in a two-year orbit. Our Jupiter orbits every 12 years. It's much further out. And I'm going to show you Jupiters that are orbiting every 3 days. Okay, so this is the first sign that these planets don't smell right. Okay, if all you know is the solar system, they look different. Okay, now I have a couple of other examples just to show you some real measurements that people make. Now here's an amazing one. Look at this. It's kind of slow. It's slowly changing velocity, and then boom, a quick change in velocity, and then a slow change, and a quick change. What does that mean? Eccentric, that's right. So it's whipping around, a big velocity change really quickly, and then it goes slowly. And so you can imagine by looking at the detailed shape, you can actually get the eccentricity by fitting a model to this detailed shape. And here's one which looks very strange. That's because it has more than one planet. Here are several planets all on top of each other. There's So you see, it's not a nice regular. There's kind of a second bump here, and here's a second bump again. And it's on a long time scale. It goes up and then down, and then there's something going up and down, up and down. So there are different time scales here. This actually has four planets in here. So we make these measurements, and then the idea is to try and untangle that. And here there happen to be four different planets in this one. Okay. So that's actually the technique that's been used for most of the planets. But let me tell you about another technique which has been used to find 50 planets now, and that's transiting. That's the technique of transits. And, I have a little movie here. Let's go back. Go back in time. There we are. Okay, so what's happening here is that if we're very lucky, the orbit of the planet will be edge-on relative to our line of sight. So in other words, the planet, in a certain part of its orbit, will cross in front of the star, and here it is. You see, eventually, there it is. There's the planet. Now, it's going around in its orbit, but the orbit happens to cross in front of the star. Now, Jupiter, remember, was 10 times, a tenth of the radius of the sun in that table I gave you. So that this sphere here, you can see moving across, has a radius of only 10% of the solar radius. So the area that it covers is only 1%. So as the planet moves in front, it covers 1% of the area of the star. And what that means is that if I just look at that star, whenever the planet passes in front, it'll be a little bit fainter by 1%. So I measure the brightness of that star, and every once in orbit, it'll get fainter by 1%. Again, very hard. Okay, imagine looking at a star, trying to measure its, very precisely measure its luminosity, get the brightness to these accuracies or more. Now let me show you some data from this technique. So there are 50 planets that have been discovered this way. I thought I would show you this data because it's from a Canadian... did you know we have a Canadian space telescope? I'm not sure if you knew that. It's called MOST. And here it is. There's a cartoon character that looks like this. It's usually mentioned. I forget the name. A yellow cartoon character. SpongeBob, yeah, that's it. Okay, that's the quiz for this week. And here's an example of a light curve. So look at the top panel, and this zooms in. Look what happens. Here's the light from the star, and all of a sudden it begins to drop. Look, there it goes. And it drops down, and then it comes up again. And that's because a Jupiter mass planet is moving in front of this star. And you can imagine, if you measure this very precisely, you see here the measurements are very precise. The error bars are tiny. We've really measured this very well. And if you measure the dip here, you learn about the area of that planet, or in other words, its radius. So whereas with radial velocities, all you can measure is really the mass, because it's the mass that gives you the tug, that gives you the radial velocity. This method is very interesting because it tells you the radius. So we can actually start to learn about the planet. What's its radius? Not just mass, but also radius. Okay. And I should mention there are other techniques. I don't have time really to go into them, but I'll mention direct imaging. I said planets are very hard to see. They're very faint. But there are now direct images of planets. And here is an amazing announcement that came out last November 2008. And I hope you can see this. There's a big sort of blob here in the middle. That's what's left of the star. The problem is, if I look at a star and I want to see the planet is so faint relative to the star that all I see is the star. So you look at the light bulb and you're trying to see a tiny light bulb. So you get the idea. The planet's so faint, it's hard to pick up because of the glare of the bright star. And here what they've done is very carefully subtract out that star. So there's a bit left over. You see that's what all this noise is here. There's a bit of the star left over. But very carefully they've taken that out. And look at what's left. There's a dot there. There's another one, a red dot. And there's another one. Those are three planets. They're very massive. They're 10 Jupiter mass planets, something like that. And they're at large distance, 20 astronomical units is this bar here. So these are out at 30, 40, 50 astronomical units. So much larger than Pluto, than 50 times the Earth's orbit on a large scale compared to our Jupiter. And if you look even more closely, I don't know if you can see this, but there are two points. There's a cross and a red dot for each of them, a cross and a red dot. The cross is the location in July 2004, and the red dot is the location last September. So they move. Right? They orbit. They're going around in their orbits. We can watch them go around. Okay? So that is amazing. So we only know there are very few, just a handful of observations like this, but in the future, this is something that we'll be able to do much better. And I should mention that there's a large Canadian effort involved in this. So Christian Moreau was the lead author here from the Hertzberg Institute of Astrophysics in Victoria. And René Doyon at the University of Montreal was also a member of this team. So it was some local expertise there on this. And I put in the handout some HTTP web addresses. I want to move on now and just show you what these planets actually look like that have been discovered, these 350 planets. And you can do this yourself at home. Okay, just go to these websites. Here's exoplanet.eu. And you'll find a catalog of all the latest exoplanets, a list of all these 300 planets. And you can make plots. It's kind of fun. You can make plots of their masses and their radii and their periods and their eccentricities. You can play around with the data. I don't have this one on the handout. There's planetquest.jpl.nasa.gov, which is also very nice. It has a lot of information about different satellite missions, different experiments to find planets, and the future of the field. So that's a very nice place. And they also have a widget, which I have on my desktop here. I hope that wasn't a mistake. No, it wasn't. Here we are. Oh, maybe it was. It's not actually working. Okay. Well, that's okay. That's okay. We'll go back. Maybe that was a mistake. They have a widget. I don't feel, on a Mac, I think on PC, they have these little widgets. So you press the button, up comes a little widget, and it tells you right now how many planets are there. Okay, so I keep pressing F12, and now there are 364, now there are 365. Okay, let me just get this working again, so apologies there. There we are. Okay. Here we go. There we are. Okay. Whew. Had a sigh there from the front row. Very good. But if we were able to, so go home, install your widget, then every day you can see how many planets there are. Okay, that's the message. And there are 346 today. You just have to believe me. Okay. 346. And counting. Now, over time, you can make a plot of the mass of the planets in Earth masses versus time from 1992 going all the way out to today. And all these planets have been discovered. They're getting less towards lower and lower masses. We're finding lower and lower masses. I'll mention that later. A better way, rather than look at the plot like that, is just look at the headlines. Okay, so I pulled out some headlines. This will give you a sense of the field. So in 1995, actually 1992, this is an amazing fact actually. So in 1992, remember from Vicky Caspi you heard about pulsars, neutron stars which are sending out radio pulses. The first planets to be discovered were actually around a pulsar. So there's a pulsar with very, very low mass planets, much less than the Earth. I think there are three or four in that system. And that was in 1992. What an amazing place to live, a planet around a pulsar. But the 300 I want to talk about today are around stars like our sun. And in 1995, two groups were Michel Mayor et al., a Swiss group, and also a California group led by Jeff Marcy, Paul Butler in California. They announced the discovery of a planet around the star 51 Pegasus. And that was in 1995. And so you can imagine big news. Okay. Now, 5 years later, 2000, we look in the New York Times. It's actually from the Astrophysical Journal, the first one. But you know, it's so exciting, this field. We don't publish in the Astrophysical Journal anymore. We just go to the New York Times. Okay, so, six new planets from the Keck Velocity Survey, June 2000. So, you know, by 5 years in, we're announcing six at a time. You know, no longer just big news finding one. Astronomers find evidence for eight objects, New York Times, May 2000. So basically, people started to announce multiple planets at a time, finding so many. Now, all these planets here are Jupiter masses. They're the most massive ones, easiest to detect. But here in 2000 also, you see there's sub-Saturn, so less massive than Saturn, so getting down below 100 Earth masses. And then here, I like this headline, found two planetary systems. Result, astronomers stunned. Okay. Now we go ahead 5 years again. So 1995, first discovery, 2000, finding lots of planets getting below Saturn. We go to 2005, alien planets show themselves for the first time. We didn't detect any aliens, but what this is referring to, we're beginning to characterize these planets. So no longer are we just detecting them, but we're starting to learn about them. We're characterizing their properties. We're trying to learn about their size. We're trying to learn about their atmospheres, and I'll show you some of this things that we've learned. Study of two alien planets show no evidence of water. And then, of course, today, Charles mentioned today, I made a slide on this. Here we are. The lightest planet yet announced today or yesterday. Two Earth masses now. Two Earth masses. Okay. In a three-day orbit. Imagine living that close to the star. So the year is 3 days. This star is very low mass. It's only 0.3 solar masses, so it's very red, actually. So if you live there, it's a very red star, very close. And this star is actually amazing. It has four detected planets. I'll mention that a little later. And here's the cartoon. What you do, you're sitting very close to the smallest one, the two Earth mass one. It looks very big. But that's just because we're in orbit around it, and we're looking out. This is not data. This is a cartoon, unfortunately. So here's my Earth mass two Earth mass planet here, and I'm looking out towards the red sun. I see it over there, and there are three planets here, three other planets. The blue one, there's a little dot. It's a little dot, but those are far away, so I just see a little dot. But that's what you would see if you were sitting on this two Earth mass planet in the system. And just to give you a sense of the data, remember before we had these velocity measurements and they made a huge swing. You could easily see the swing. It was a huge signal. Look at what they're doing now. They have to make many observations to be able to pull this out. It's a small signal. It's hard to get down to these very low masses. And you see there's a very slight wobble here. The line draws your eye again. But you have to make many observations to be able to pull this out. Okay. Okay, those are the basically two main ways the bulk of the planets have been discovered so far, radio velocity measurements and the transiting method. And let me just show you, and I gave you a sense of the history of the field. Every 5 years, we're sort of moving on in this way, and now we have 350. Let me show you what they look like. So I'll talk a little bit about what these planets actually look like. And let's think about, first of all, remember in the solar system, we had the orbital properties, and we had the physical properties, like the radius. Let's look first at the orbital properties. So what are the orbits like? Okay, so let's first of all, I made a plot of these. So every cross on this diagram, every triangle or every cross is a detected planet. And I'm plotting its mass in Earth masses and its period in days of its orbit going around. Now, what do you see when you look at this plot? Any reactions? Yes. So there seems to be a... That's right. There's a bunch here. There are many coming in, but they're not out of many thousands of days. Now, that's because this is a young field, in a sense. We've only been looking for 10, maybe 15 years, if we're lucky, say 10 years. So if I don't see it go all the way around, I can't be really convinced it's a planet. That's the problem. If I only see it move a little way, I might see a little bit of a velocity, but it doesn't come all the way back and nicely close the orbit into this nice repeating shape. So that's really why they're short periods. Now, where's Jupiter on this diagram? Jupiter would be at 1, and Jupiter's about 12 years. It's out here. So Jupiter's about here on this diagram where the arrow is. So our solar system, all the other planets are much less massive. So all the other planets in our solar system would lie down here at lower masses. So really, if we were looking at our solar system from afar and we made these measurements, we would see a dot here. Okay, so what's striking to me is that every part of that space is filled. Right, that's one thing you can take away from this. That these planets have all properties you can imagine. You know, whatever you want, I'll give it to you. Okay, you want a two Jupiter mass planet orbiting every 3 days? No problem. Or if we want a two Jupiter mass planet orbiting every year where the Earth is in our solar system, here it is. Okay. Now, of course, down here, it's not completely filled. So down here at low masses, there aren't that many, you see. But that's because low masses are hard to detect, as I showed you with this two Earth, very hard to detect. So the ones we've seen are mostly Jupiter masses, and they're spread out over a whole range of periods. So really nothing like the solar system. So that's the first, and the first one to be discovered was actually one right in here, a three-day orbit. The 51 Pegasus was in a three-day orbit, so immediately people realized, you know, we've been thinking about the solar system having a Jupiter orbiting every 12 years, but that really doesn't seem to be typical given the sample that we have. Now let's look at eccentricity. So here I'm plotting eccentricity. Remember, it's a number that goes from 0 to 1. And what do you notice here? What do you notice? They're mostly not zero. They're spread all over again. So they range all the way. Some are close to zero, but most of them are out here, 0.1, 0.2, 0.3. They tend to look like this. The ones we found tend to look like this. They're not in these nice circular orbits. So again, if as a good theorist you've explained how to make the solar system, you better start thinking again, because we have to now make these planets that are going around in these eccentric orbits. There are something like 40 multiple planet systems known, and multiple planet systems, so with more than one planet. Most of these points I plotted here are a single planet going around the sun, and we've only seen one because we can only see the most massive one. The low mass ones are hard to see. But in some systems, we've seen more than one. So this plot shows that. It's a function of distance from the star. Here's the star. It's not the scale. But here's the star, just to give you a sense. These are all different examples of detected solar systems around other stars. And they have all these planets here, bunches of planets. Okay. And one of the most striking things is that, do you know what a metal is to an astronomer? It's anything heavier than helium. Okay? So an astronomer has a very simple view of the universe: hydrogen, helium, metals. Okay? And it doesn't have to be a metal. It doesn't have to conduct heat, or it doesn't have to be like a piece of copper. But, you know, this mouse is made of metal. But the idea is that most of the universe is hydrogen helium. Most of Jupiter is hydrogen helium gas. But there is some metals, heavier elements than helium there. And if you remember my story for making planets, we said that I take bits of dirt, bits of graphite or silicate, and I bunch up all these pieces and make rocks by bunching them up. Those rocks are metals in astronomy. And you might expect if I look at a star with more metals, then it has more building blocks for the planets, so I should see more planets. Or it should be a bigger chance. And that's one of the main discoveries that have been made. This is an astronomer's notation, but basically over here is lots of metals, lots of heavy elements. Over here, not so many. The sun is in the middle. The sun is a little bit metal-rich compared... The sun is a zero, defined to be zero. The sun is here. So as I go to something with more metals, I'm more likely to find a planet there. And you see these numbers are like 20 or 25%. If I have lots of building blocks, then one in four of the stars we've looked at will have a planet. So they're very common, very, very common, 20, 30%, maybe higher around stars. Okay. So that's the orbital properties. Let me just show you quickly what the physical properties look like. And, here we go. That's a good. Here's another animation of a transit. And here's the Jupiter. Here's the Jupiter, and it's going around. And we're looking at the star. And every time the Jupiter passes in front of the star, we see a dip in the light. And remember, I mentioned that dip can tell you the radius. So we've measured now the radius of. I'll come back to the movie. Those of you who like movies, it's getting late now. But here these points here, these purple points are a plot of radius against mass. How heavy is the planet? How big is it? We plot the points here. Jupiter is around there where the mouse is, and the purple points are all these transiting planets, the planets that pass in front of their star, and we have radius measurements for these now. So there are 20 or 30 measurements of the radius of the star, of the planet, and that tells you something about what it's made of. And so that's really where we are now, trying to figure out what are these things made of. And the reason that we can tell from a radius measurement what the planet is made of goes back to density. If you look at the handout I gave you, remember I gave you these densities. If I have a Jupiter mass planet and it's made of hydrogen, or a Jupiter mass planet made of iron, if I could do such a thing, the iron one would be much smaller because iron is so much denser, right? For a given mass, it'll be much smaller. So the idea is to make measurements of the radius, and from that try to figure out what these planets are made of. And we don't have enough range yet in the measurements, but this is something for the future. This is really where we are now in the field, going ahead, trying to measure the radius of planets and try to figure out what's inside them. Okay, well, let me just show you a couple of fun things that you can do with these hot Jupiters. Okay, so imagine I give you a telescope and I say, oh, this star here has a hot Jupiter. Why do you think we call it hot Jupiter? It's one of these Jupiters orbiting every 3 days. It's really close to the sun. Imagine if we move the Earth. Please don't do this. Imagine moving the Earth in towards the sun so it orbits only every 3 days. It's going to be really hot because you're really close to the sun. So imaginatively, we've called these hot Jupiters. And these are the ones that we see transiting, because if I'm really far out, I don't transit very often. And the chance that I have an orbit that's going to transit is very small. You have to be in close to be able to see this thing going in front of the star with a high probability. And Let's imagine that we want to learn even more. You know, what do we really want to learn going ahead? We want to find planets. We want to find, ideally, Earth mass planets. We want to measure their atmosphere. For example, if we want to detect signatures of life, imagine if we want to find out if there's life on a planet. How could we do it? We could look at the atmosphere of the planet and try to figure out what elements are there. Okay, is there carbon dioxide, right, for example? Look at oxygen levels, ozone. You know, I'm trying to measure the chemical molecules, for example, in the atmosphere. And here's a chance to do that. Because look at that. Let's play the movie again. Okay. Here are two chances. So the first one is the planet is going to cross in front of the star. Now, as it goes in, as the planet moves across, and as it's entering in front of the star, the first thing that enters in front of the star is the atmosphere. So as I go in like this, I get a snapshot over time of different layers in the atmosphere. That's the first thing we can do. So there it goes. If I measure that very carefully, I'll get to see the atmosphere. Now look when it comes back. Okay, when the planet is behind the star, I don't see the planet, I only see the star. But right before the planet goes behind the star, I can see the planet and the star. So if I can make a measurement, we'll make two measurements, we'll make it, get ready, now, okay? So the first one, I had the star and the planet, and the second one, I only had the star. Now I subtract them, what's left over is the planet. So both of these techniques have now been used. Okay. And just to show you an exciting result there. Okay, here's a spectrum, one of the first spectrum. This is just happening in the last 2 years. There's a space telescope called the Spitzer Space Telescope, which measures in the infrared. It's an infrared space telescope. And people have done exactly both of those methods. And here is one result coming from the first method where we look at the planet going in front of the star and we try to measure the atmosphere that way. And they, unfortunately, the gray line here is a model. It's a theoretical model. So all this detail is not measured. It's just a theorist dreaming up a model. But the crosses are the observations that were made. So in three different infrared wavelengths, we measure the luminosity of we measure the absorption of the atmosphere of the planet at those three different wavelengths. And you can see it's not the same. It changes. So as I choose different infrared wavelengths, I get different amounts of absorption. And that's the characteristic of water. Okay, so the claim here is that what we're seeing here, the reason that these crosses are different amounts of absorption is because of water absorption. So there's the first detection of water here in one of these exoplanets. So this Jupiter has water in its atmosphere. Okay. So as I mentioned, where is this going in the future? Let me show you a couple of things and then I'll come to a close. Where is this going in the future? We want to find Earths. We particularly want to find Earths in the habitable zone. There's something called a habitable zone, which is basically where can I have liquid water? If I put the planet too close, it's going to be too hot. If I put the planet too far away, it's going to be too cold. There's a zone called the habitable zone where I can have liquid water. I might be able to get life, as we know it at least. And this shows that a habitable zone is a function of stellar mass of the star. And I show you this because here's the announcement today. They discovered the pink planet today. This is the 2 Earth mass. And this system I mentioned has 4 planets, 1, 2, 3, 4, at different distances from its star. And the habitable zone for this planet, for this star, is here. So you can see this is a very interesting system because it has a couple of planets right on the edge. Unfortunately, not in the middle, but right on the edge of this habitable zone. Unfortunately, D and C are very massive. D and C are, I forget the masses, but they're much more massive than one Earth. So we have a 2 Earth mass planet here, but it's not inside the habitable zone, unfortunately. But this is the idea. If we keep finding, we're looking for, ideally, something like an Earth in a habitable zone, could have liquid water, could have life. Okay. And something to keep an eye on for the news is to look. There was a mission that was launched in March the 6th this year. It's called the Kepler satellite. And it's just staring. It's staring at 100,000 stars. Doesn't sound very interesting, but you basically stare for 3 years. You stare at 100,000 stars. Here they are. Here's its first image. Just came out April 8th. They turned on the telescope. They look out at these 100,000 stars. Here they are, little dots. And they're going to look for 3 years. and they're going to look for transits. They're going to look for planets passing in front of the star, and they should discover many, many Jupiter-sized planets, but specifically what they really want to look for are Earths. So keep in the next 2 years, you should hear about this. Keep an eye on the New York Times, the scientific journal, and you'll hear about the discovery of Earths. Okay. And if you go to that website I mentioned at JPL, you'll be able to find out about lots of other activities, lots of other missions, the James Webb Space Telescope, the Terrestrial Planet Finder, a planet finder's dream, a mission called Gaia. There's lots coming up in the next 5-10 years and beyond to achieve this goal of finding Earth-mass planets and life. Okay, so let me just go back to what you should take home. You now know there are 300 planets. You can go home and look them up, see what they're like, give them names. Planets are common in our galaxy. We didn't know that 10 years ago. They're very diverse. They've been surprising. They have surprising properties. And keep an eye out in the news. You'll hear about Earth shortly. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Andrew, for this beautiful lecture. So on behalf of the Faculty of Science, I'd like to present you with this memorable gift.
Thank you.
Thank you for your
thank
efforts.
You very much.
And now it's a question and answer period time. So please write down your questions and give the questions to the volunteers, and I'll be happy to ask them on your behalf to Professor Cumming. So the progress in this field has been remarkable over, say, 12 years, 15 years?
Yes, since 1995 was the first one.
That's just amazing. I can't think of an area of physics that moves as fast, actually. It's amazing. It's remarkable.
Thank you.
Okay, here's a question for you, Andrew. So you sort of emphasized that we're looking specifically for Earth-sized planet and has habitable planets. Why is that? Is it the size that makes them habitable or not?
Well, so if we're interested in finding life, I guess that's one motivation. It helps to be in the habitable zone. We think, you know, the water is perhaps essential to have life. As far as we know, but also it helps to have a surface. So I think it helps to have an atmosphere, for example. So if I have a rocky surface, that's good. Maybe if I have oceans, if I can support an atmosphere, if I don't have enough mass or a large enough gravity, I can't support an atmosphere, for example. So if you think about what is special about the Earth in terms of making conditions for life, then that is something that then you can think about what kind of planets would we really want to find.
All right. Thank you, Andrew. Here's another one. How can a large gas planet orbit so quickly close to the star without having the gas blown away by the solar wind?
That's actually a really good question. Remember, these are very... So there are actually some observations of material possibly blowing away from one of these hot Jupiters. It's something that is an open question in the field. You might have noticed, it's a detail in one of the plots I showed, that these hot Jupiters tend to be a little bit less massive than the other Jupiters. If I go further out, they tend to be 5 or 6 Jupiters, but if I go in, they're all less than one. And so one idea that was raised in the field was that maybe the solar wind or maybe the radiation just heating the surface can blow off material. And so that's really an open question, not yet solved in the field, about whether or not the mass could decrease over time by these effects. It's a very good question.
So in the back of our minds when we do this, I guess we think about finding life. Do we have a way to detect life? So we look for life. What is it we look for?
In this field, the dream telescope I talked about, the astronomer's dream, is called the Terrestrial Planet Finder, which is really just now a mission concept being developed by NASA. Actually, consists of 2 satellites, but the goal there is to look for biosignatures. So the idea is to again look at the chemical makeup of the atmosphere And the idea is, are there particular chemical signatures of an atmosphere, a particular ratio of certain molecules or a particular presence of a particular molecule that is an indicator of life, that there are life processes going on? And that's really the main way that we have, we can't go to these planets, but we can study their atmospheres from afar, and that's certainly one way we can go after this question.
Perhaps in connection with last week's iteration of our series, we heard about galaxy mergers. Do planets ever collide? Is this possible?
Yes, they do. When worlds collide, collisions are an important part of the process by which planets are formed. So early in their life, they've had many, 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 many collisions. Part of the way that these rocks stick together is in collisional processes. If you think about how did the moon form, event to form the moon is that there was a massive collision of maybe a Mars-sized object with the Earth. And the moon condenses out a material disrupted from the Earth by a huge collision like that. If you look at the moon, if you look at objects in the solar system, you see craters from collisions with material. So at the final stages of planet formation, you settle down into a planet is able to scatter out material, small bodies from its orbit. It either captures those bodies or it ejects them from the system. So collisions eventually will become rare, but they're happening throughout the whole life of the solar system. I don't have any predictions about the future for collisions with the Earth.
I guess a question on the opening statements of your talk, your first or second slide. Whatever happened to Pluto? it used to be a planet, right?
So yeah, I carefully skirted around the controversial subject of Pluto. So that's right. So in 2006, the international body, the IAU, came out with a definition of a planet. Now, we haven't had to do this before, because there was always such a big gap between the mass of planetary bodies and the mass of other bodies in the solar system. And so it was always pretty clear, these are planets and these aren't. But what's been happening is that there are many bodies in the solar system now which are very similar to Pluto. Some of them there are bigger objects than Pluto. Pluto is believed to be only one of many, many, many objects which are orbiting at large distance from the Sun. And so there came this question of how should we define what is a planet. Now also actually, in one of my plots, if I showed you the mass of these Jupiters, some of them are 10 Jupiter masses or beyond. So also when I go to the high mass end, you might start to wonder about, is a 20 Jupiter mass planet a planet, or when does it become what's known as a brown dwarf, which is a very low mass star? So I can take a star and make it less and less massive, take a planet and make it more and more massive, and eventually there comes a disconnect. I can have an object with the same mass. What do I call it? And so at both mass ends, low mass and high mass, we have to think more carefully about what is a planet. And so the definition that a committee came up with was that a dwarf planet, that a planet has to be round. It has to be self-gravitating. So it has such a large gravity, it forms a round shape. It has to be capable of scattering out bodies. I just mentioned that a planet can clear out its neighborhood of rocky bodies by ejecting them from the system, and it has to be able to do that. That's one of the definitions. And it shouldn't be a moon. Okay, so it shouldn't be a satellite of an already named planet. Okay, so those are the three conditions that we came up with. And there's some controversy, but at some level, this is actually exciting news. So my take on this, one attitude is that it's very sad, to go into schools and have to teach our children that there are only 8 planets now. But that's actually very exciting. Okay, it's incredibly exciting, because what it means is that instead of having one Pluto there, we now have thousands of those things that we know about. We're learning more and more about the structure of our own solar system, not just extrasolar systems, but our own solar system. It's actually incredibly exciting that we have to make this choice about what we call a planet and what we call a dwarf planet. It means that we're making tremendous progress in studying our own solar system as well as others.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it used to be something called the Drake equation. you calculate the probability for intelligent life to exist. And I guess in one of those, one of the elements in the Drake equation is, given the sun, what's the probability of the sun to have planets around it?
That's right. Yes.
So with what we know now, can we say something more specific about that element or that parcel of the Drake equation?
That's right. So the idea is you have an equation, and you have, say, about six different things that go into this. Six different things you want to calculate. What's the probability of this intelligent life in the galaxy? And if you think about that, we know how many stars there are. That would be one number. We have 100 billion stars we're going to consider. How many of those have a planet? That's what we need to know if intelligent life lives on planets. And we do indeed know something about that number now, at least for massive planets. So if you ask me how many... what fraction of stars have massive gas giant planets? I can tell you that number. Okay, it depends on the metallicity. It depends on how many metals there are. But it's around 10, 20%, something like that, within the orbit of Jupiter. Okay, so they're very common. These gas giants are very common. Now, we are getting some information about rocky planets, about Earth or 10 Earth mass planets. Sometimes, if I have a planet of several Earth masses, it's called a super Earth. So you might read about super Earths. And those are being discovered very close to the star, because if I'm very close, I can still have a big effect on the star and make it wobble. And so very close to the star in these three-day orbits, we know now a handful of several Earth mass planets. But it's too early to say what that number should be in the Drake equation. And certainly if I go out to one astronomical unit, the position of the Earth, we don't know that number yet. But one of the aims of the Kepler mission, I mentioned this mission Kepler, which just launched, it's going to stare at these stars for 3 years, 100,000 stars. The reason they chose 100,000 is that they want to be able to say something about this number. So in 3 years, we will know, hopefully we will know the number. Hopefully they will see these Earths and then we will know what that number is. But if not, we'll have a very good idea of what it is. If we don't see anything with Kepler, then that number has to be less than 10%. Okay, so if more than 10% of stars have an Earth, Kepler should see it. Okay, and so you'll hear about that in the next couple of years.
So you do these surveys and you look at things. Do you do this randomly, or how do you decide which stars to look at to find planets?
That's right. So I mentioned that it's very difficult to do these measurements. So for example, the radial velocity measurements, you're measuring a shift of only 1 part in 300 million of the wavelength of the line. It helps to have a bright star to be able to do that. So if I have a very bright star, I could do that much more easily. So I look at the close ones, basically. So there is a systematic way to choose the stars, and one way would be to look at the bright ones, and so I look at the closest ones. And the number now is roughly about 3,000. The 3,000 closest stars to the sun have been surveyed now for gas giants. But if I can't look at a star on the other side of the galaxy, it's too faint. Okay, using this radial velocity technique. And then there are other things that people try to do. For example, we now know metals are important to make planets. So I could choose stars. If I'm making a new survey, I could choose stars which are metal rich. And so there's a survey underway, for example, which is looking at metal rich stars. And they know they're going to find a larger than average fraction. Or if I'm interested in measuring the velocity, I could look at low mass stars, because low mass stars have are pulled more by the planets, so they move more and they're easier to detect. So things like that. So those factors do go in. It's actually a very complex subject, trying to figure out exactly which stars should I be looking at. How do I maximize my chances of finding planets?
The next question is about you. I like this one. people, physicists are ordinary people too. Keep going. People have read your biography. You've done neutron star calculations.
Yes.
What provoked your interest in this field? Why are you doing that now?
Yeah. Why? If the question is why would I work on neutron stars and planets? What do they have in common?
Into the question, let's answer this one. And
what do you think? They're both round. Just a joke. well, actually, it goes back to a little bit to the extreme. I mean, the reason that planets are interesting, I think, is really because of everything I've talked about tonight. That it's just this. It's all of those questions I gave in the beginning. Where do we come from? What's the history of the solar system? All these questions. Is there life out there? Those kind of questions. But then, as a physicist, there are also many questions of interest. If you think of, I told you the story about particles sticking together, for example, and there's a whole series of problems in there. You can imagine if I have two boulders and I fire them together, bang, do those boulders stick? Not necessarily, right? It's not obvious. And so there's an interesting physics problem there, some interesting physics in the whole process of making planets. Or as I mentioned, if the connection with neutron stars is if I go into the center of a planet like Jupiter, it's incredibly high pressure. You wouldn't want to go there. And I mentioned the hydrogen, for example, becomes a metal if I squeeze it to high enough pressure. And those kind of... these objects in the laboratories, and you heard from Vicky Caspi about neutron stars, there's no way we can make a neutron star material on Earth, something that dense, that cold on Earth. We just can't do it. And so these are laboratories, if you like, to test physics that we don't really get to experience in every day on Earth. And so that those are the motivations, really, I think.
You've told us that, the solar system, ours, for example, is the sun and planets orbiting around it. Do solar systems themselves orbit around other objects?
They do indeed. So we actually know some of that sample I showed you, some of those planets are orbiting a sun, but that sun is part of a binary system. And so you have two stars orbiting each other, and one of them has a planet orbiting as well. So planets, you may know that most stars form in binaries. When I form a star, I typically will make a binary system and have a star, have two stars orbiting, or even more than that, more than two. And so planet formation is not confined to single stars. It's clearly happening in the binary star system. And you can imagine there are interesting physics problems there. If I'm on a planet orbiting a star, do I care that there's another star going by? Maybe. It's a very massive thing. Okay, if it's too close, then it could actually disrupt the solar system and the planets fly out. So questions like that are also questions that we'd like to answer by looking for more and more planets in binaries and try to see, is there a difference? Are the ones in binaries different from the ones not in binaries, for example?
I guess the other question is also perhaps about our own solar system. So you've told us that there's a sun and the planets are more or less in the same plane. What about their axis of rotation? Is it random or is it more or less aligned?
It's not always aligned. So it depends which planet you're looking at. You might expect, if you think about forming this disk during the formation of the star, the planets are moving around in a disk. There's a natural... the angular momentum of the system, the rotation of the planets, is a well-defined axis for that. And you might imagine that the spin of each planet, because the planet's growing from material from the disk, that the rotation of the planet would be in the same sense and in the same plane as the rotation around. But that's not always true. And that's something that we want to look at again in these exoplanet systems. You can actually measure that, it turns out. You can. There are ways to try to go after that.
It'd be a bit of speculation. We're looking for life, right? So life, probably we define it as we know it.
Yes.
Are we ruling out exotic life? I mean, what are our minimal requirements for life? How do we define life?
That's a great question. that's right. We know what we know, and that's part of the excitement of a field like this. That it could turn out to be completely different. We thought that every solar system had a Jupiter of 5 AU, 5 astronomical units, and that's the way it was. And it turns out it's completely wrong. So it could be that. Life is not the way we know it in other solar systems.
Fair answer. And now, perhaps the last question, my question.
Okay.
What's a technical question? It's very simple. What's the maximum number of planets we've discovered around a given star?
So, if I remember correctly, it's five now. but actually it may be six. Things move. I need my widget to find out. It's something like five or six. There's a system with five or six planets. And we can't detect Earths yet, so that tells you that they're all above Earth mass. They're all 10 Earths or Jupiters or several Jupiters. So imagine that, a system with multiple Jupiters orbiting around. Imagine what it would be like to be there.
Again, that's remarkable. I mean, it's remarkable. In 15 years, we've gone so far. Next week, replacing Dean Grant, will be Associate Dean Peter Grutter, and he will be hosting Professor Robert Rutledge from the Department of Physics. And Bob will be speaking in the galaxy far, far away, measuring the size of the universe. So I'd like to thank you for coming, and I'd like to, again, thank Professor Andrew coming for a wonderful lecture.